Everybody does it. You pop to the supermarket, and while you're there, you grab some cash from the ATM. Nobody ever thinks about who owns the ATM or whether it's part of the supermarket. But that's what lawyers are for. And so a dispute over this very issue has been the subject of a recent, keenly anticipated Court of Appeal decision. While our official case name is Cardtronics Europe Limited and others, the Sykes Valuation Officer and others, those others included some pretty big names: Tesco, Sainsbury's, and the Cooperative Group. Today, in the latest episode of On the Case, Brian Johnston, partner at Dentons, which acted for Sainsbury's and the Co-op, explains exactly why the supermarket chains were so concerned. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks, Jess.
So, what was the issue at the heart of this case, and how did it arise?
Well, there are really a number of issues at the heart of the case. At the macro level, there's a lot of pressure being felt by retailers in respect of high rents, whether a retailer is a leaseholder, wage inflation, mm-hmm. and business rates. Now, rates are a tax on property occupation. Therefore, the more property you own, the greater the rates liability is. If bricks and mortar are an integral part of your business, then you're at a competitive disadvantage over similar businesses, mm-hmm. but which do not have significant portfolios of property. Furthermore, there's many ATMs in many different places. They are access points for banking services that members of the public would not otherwise enjoy. Access to cash is for many an essential service. If ATMs are less commercially viable, then the corollary of this is that there will be fewer ATMs in the network. Mm. Not good news if you live in a village or small town with no bank and are dependent on the ATM machine for cash. So that's the macro level. Looking more at the micro level, the issue is whether an ATM is a separate unit of property for business rates purposes, mm-hmm. what's known as in legal language, as a hereditament. If not, it's not subject to business rates. If it is a hereditament, then it will attract a rateable value and be subject to business rates. So you create a hereditament, you create rateable value, and therefore that is liable to business rates. Now you may say, so what? The separate ATM space added to the separate store space is still the same amount of space as the original store unit with the ATM. Well, that may be so, but the separation of the ATM unit is not taxation neutral. The separation creates a new unit with its own rateable value, whereas the store rateable value is unlikely to be proportionately reduced. In short, the Valuation Office Agency's actions amount to fiscal alchemy, creating rateable value where it didn't previously exist.
Magic.
Now, there's a wider issue as well. ATMs are just one type of third-party-owned machine. If a valuation office can separately rate an ATM machine, then can it so list a water cooler, a prize grab machine, a coffee machine? Now, the case originated out of the valuation office separately listing multiple ATM machines in retailer stores. The original claimants had no option except to launch multiple appeals, and we're talking about many thousands of appeals to the listings, in order to protect their position and, of course, their wider group's position. Mm. In the case of Sainsbury's, it was Sainsbury's itself, the supermarket, and Sainsbury's Bank. So it's all part of the same group. That's why it's relevant. Absent that, the listings would have bound the claimants together, and the overall rates liability for exactly the same space would have increased.
And while at each individual site, you might only be talking about a fairly small amount of difference in overall rates, across the whole country, with all those supermarket ATMs and other ATMs at other sites, the difference could add up to some pretty significant sums, couldn't it?
Yes, very much so. If we look at it like this, in the context of major national retailers, individual rateable values for ATMs in a portfolio may not be significant. So at the individual level, not significant. However, given the extent of the ATM network, the maths quickly gets you into an overall rateable value in the millions. This, of course, is just for 1 year. Mm. The ultimate extra over liability would continue from the 2010 list through the 2017 list and beyond. In crude and hypothetical terms, by way of example, if we assume a rateable value figure of £3,000 for an ATM, and then assume a portfolio of, say, 1,500 ATMs, the total annual rateable value amounts to £4.5 million. That is the rateable value for just 1 year when previously there was no separate listing. That is 4.5 million created out of thin air. If we then apply this to just the life of the 2010 and the 2017 rating lists, this equates to a rateable value of nearly £50 million. An extremely significant value by any standards.
Certainly is. So it's not surprising then that the case was very strongly fought. Can you summarise what the key arguments were on each side?
Certainly. There are many different arguments brought, but essentially, looking at it like this, I'll start with the claimants and then move on to the Valuation Office. The claimants brought a number of test cases. I think it's important to know that from the outset. So they are actually bringing the test cases, and they covered a different range of ATM types and locations. These included fixed and mobile machines, and machines that were internally situated, and machines that were externally facing. So your typical hole-in-the-wall machine facing out onto car park, public street, etc. Now, the claimants, their position was that at law, no separate ATM hereditament should exist. No separate unit should exist. There were a number of arguments that were deployed. The two key ones were based on the legal test for determining if a hereditament exists, namely whether there is beneficial, exclusive, actual occupation that is not too transient. Applying that, the claimants argued that a space occupied by an ATM machine on an undifferentiated area of floor space within the wider property lacked the requisite definition and permanence to qualify as a hereditament. Didn't have the degree of definition and it was too transient to qualify as a hereditament. In respect of the more fixed ATM machines, whilst both the bank and the retailer had an interest in the sites of these could not be separate hereditaments, as the retailers remained in rateable occupation of the sites as the paramount occupier. As paramount occupier, there is no separate occupation by the bank for rating purposes, and consequently, there can be no separate hereditament. Now, as you might expect, the VOA took a very different view. Now, in respect of the more mobile ATM machines, they argued that the hereditament is fixed at the point that that decision needs to be considered. This ignores, of course, the distinction between a right of occupation by the bank of a specific site and the mere right of access to a machine wherever it happened to be located. As for their approach to the fixed ATM machines, their position was that the bank was in paramount occupation of the ATM as the retailer's wider store interest, and ATM support and facilitation of the ATM machine itself should be ignored. The narrow purpose of the ATM site as an ATM site is the sole and exclusive provision of banking services only, not the wider context that the retailers submitted.
And it's obviously reached this stage following a decision by the Upper Tribunal. So how did the UT approach the case in that previous decision?
Well, the Tribunal determined the following. It determined that the sites where the more mobile ATM machines were situated, well, they lacked the requisite degree of definition and permanence to be hereditaments. Therefore, those ATMs were not separately rateable. As for the fixed ATMs, well, the Tribunal applied a test of primary purpose to determine which of the retailers and banks' occupation happened to be paramount. At this point, the Tribunal drew a distinction between outward-facing ATMs and inward-facing ATMs. The inward-facing ATMs were not held to be separate hereditaments. The primary purpose of the ATM being the provision of a service by the retailer to customers within its store. However, outward-facing ATMs were held to be separate hereditaments, as the primary purpose was provision of banking services to a wider section of the general public. So if we look at those two things, the internal and the internal machine, it points inwards. It's targeting users of the retailer's store. So it's points, so therefore, the purpose is much more to do with what the retailer is doing. It's part of its retail offer in the language of retailers. And therefore, it was easier for the Tribunal to come to the conclusion that inward-facing ATMs were occupied by the retailer and not the bank. Therefore, no separate hereditaments. But they came to a different conclusion in respect of the external ATMs, because they were facing out onto a public highway, perhaps facing out onto a car park, and therefore members of the general public could access those, and therefore it was seen as less of a store offer, and therefore more of the occupation being for banking purposes relating to the bank, and therefore a separate hereditament. So in summary, the tribunal's decision, mobile ATMs, fixed internal ATMs, were not separate hereditaments, but fixed external ATMs were.
So a partial victory for the retailers, but that sounds like a decision that neither side would be happy with. And so obviously the case proceeded, and now the Court of Appeal has given its decision. So what's the result?
Well, in summary, the Court of Appeal held that the retailers' mobile and fixed ATM portfolios are not capable of being listed as separate hereditaments. So that's good news all round from a retailer's perspective. The court upheld the tribunal's decision that the sites of mobile machines lacked sufficient permanence and definition to be hereditaments in their own right. The court further rejected the tribunal's rationale in respect of primary purpose. Instead, the court confirmed that the entity in paramount occupation would be the entity with general control of the site. Mm-hmm. This is the key principle arising from the salient case from 1936 of Westminster and Southern Railway. And this is a position that the retailers took right from the outset in reliance upon this case, but the concept of general control. And with the decision of the Court of Appeal, it's upheld what the claimants have been arguing right from the outset, that where there is two potential occupiers of a site, it is the occupier whose general control is the occupier in paramount occupation. So the court held that the factual evidence provided strong indicia that the retailers did retain general control. How did they do that? Well, they did it by providing cleaning, maintenance and replenishment services of the ATM sites themselves. Physically speaking, in many cases, access to the ATMs were actually controlled by the retailers themselves. The presence of ATMs furthered the general business purposes of the retailer. There was no evidence whatsoever of independent, uncontrolled occupation by the banks of the ATM sites. Indeed, the court held that the evidence of a collaborative common purpose between the banks and the stores was unassailable. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the court held that the tribunal had erred in applying the primary purpose test, and instead should have considered who was in paramount occupation by dint of having general control of the sites. On the facts, this was very clearly the retailers.
So, looking ahead now, is this the end of the matter, or do you think there's any prospect of a further appeal to the Supreme Court?
Well, that very much is the multi-million pound business rates question. Look, I'd phrase it like this. The ball lies very much in the court of the Valuation Office Agency. They will need to balance a very well-written and reasoned leading judgment from Lord Justice Keith Lindblom against the prospect that the Supreme Court will reach a different outcome. The Court of Appeal has been decisive in dismissing the VOA's application for permission to appeal, though of course the VOA can apply directly to the Supreme Court. Now, there's a recent history of the Supreme Court determining rating matters. Well, we'll all be familiar with Woolway and Mazars, Newbiggin and Monk. So those are decisions that have gone all the way to the Supreme Court. I guess the retailers would hope that the Supreme Court has perhaps, well, endured enough business rates fatigue for a little while, and that it declines permission if the VOA so seeks it. The VOA would have to find an arguable point of law of general public importance within a robust and rational unanimous Court of Appeal judgment in order to engage the Supreme Court if they are minded to apply for permission to appeal.
A tough hurdle to overcome.
Absolutely right. So in terms of the practical effects on the ground, that will need to be worked out. Now, the Court of Appeal has ordered the deletion of the lead appeals. This then, of course, raises the question, well, what about those thousands of other appeals that we referred to earlier? Yep. Well, they're not test cases and they're not subject directly to the case that has been heard before the Court of Appeal. So the question there becomes, well, what would the VOA actually do in respect of those particular appeals at this present time? Well, I guess a lot of that is going to depend on what happens with the Supreme Court and whether they wish to make an application to the Supreme Court to appeal. If they don't, or if the status quo is maintained, then the retailers will be due very, very significant rebates from the billing authorities. This will, of course, be a huge financial, logistical, and no doubt administrative exercise in its own right, and there'll be repercussions, no doubt, that extend from that. But again, there's a sort of a watch this space in respect to that. Now, I don't really wish to speculate further on what the actions of the VOA and billing authorities might be at this point. I think we do have to wait to see what happens there, and I don't wish to presuppose what the VOA may be doing or thinking at this particular point in time. Obviously, they will be thinking long and hard about their next step. However, as you might expect, the claimants would strongly intend for the clear Court of Appeal judgment to be the end of the matter, and for no further public resource to be spent on finding novel ways to increase the tax take from business rates, a taxation system that remains subject to considerable criticism from the property industry.
Well, many thanks for coming in, Brian, and summarising the importance of the case for us, and particularly well done for at no point stumbling over the word hereditament. Not an easy one for a podcast, but yeah, so thanks very much. And you have been listening to On the Case from EG.